Okay, good morning, Chodesh Tov. Nice to see everybody this morning. Give me an opportunity to learn Torah with you, which is always a pleasure for me. I have to figure out the logistics. Each place is different. And I remember Rav Nati encouraged me not to wear a tie the last time I was here. So it's very hard for me. Hopefully it won't cramp my style, but you'll excuse me if it does. I think part of the reason that the Yemei Iyun are very much modeled after the Yemei Iyun at the Gush in Israel, and that's very much the climate. I remember, no pun intended, in Gush it's in the summer, it's quite hot. I remember being invited there and wearing a tie and being the only one in the whole 3,000 people. There's a lot of people over there. So I guess on some level I'm bringing a taste of Torah Eretz Yisrael to New York. In any case, I want to talk in this session about the tribal motif in Sefer Bamidbar. And it's one of these things that once you realize it's there, it's so glaring and so obvious that we're surprised that we never thought about it. And it could be all of you have already thought about it before. Could be some of you saw that I had an essay a couple months ago in Torah Musings where I developed the notion of tribal identity in the story of Shimshon, which we, if we have a chance, will speak about it. But there are many things that the Torah, the Tanakh, speaks to us with understanding, knowing that we're going to catch some things in certain generations and other things in other generations and miss things. And one of the things that I've noticed, and there's a couple of patterns that have been very helpful to me, but one of the things that I've noticed in learning Tanakh is it's extremely important to know which tribe a person is coming from, because it's very much connected to his identity in the same way that the rabbis saw our avot, our patriarchs and matriarchs, as having a tremendously deep impact upon us, and various nations also very much being rooted in their ancestors. The same is definitely the case in terms of tribal connections. And so therefore, several years back, you can look it up on YCT's website, you can find the shiur I gave on Shaul as a leader from the tribe of Benjamin, meaning that his type of malchut, his type of monarchy, was very different than David's. We're all now checking our cell phones. Okay, it's good. That has to be done, so we all turn off our cell phones, including myself. In any case, you can hear it. In terms of David and Shaul are very different, but they're very different largely because they're coming from very different approaches to life. And that's very much rooted, as far as the Tanakh is concerned, in their tribal ancestry. Okay? So where does this all start? And my proposition, my proposal to you is it very much starts in Sefer Bamidbar. In fact, so much so, someone asked me, a couple people asked me the question, you know, what's your bottom line? What's your book about? What's the Midbar about? And my answer is it's all about the tribes, which I think it is. The tribes, as we'll speak about in the context of Moshe's scheme to give over power and decentralize leadership, right? Knowing that even if he does cross the Jordan, he's not going to live forever. That's the default. He's a person. He's not going to live forever. Beyond which, there's going to be spreading out. You know, they're not going to be all grouped together as they are in the desert, and therefore there's a need to create structures that will support this new commonwealth, this new state. Okay, and what's the main structure that's used? It's a tribal structure. Okay, now so much of this is true that this really gets off the ground in Midbar, that how many times do you think the tribes are mentioned in Shemot and Vikra? Anyone want to guess? Obviously, since I introduced it, you're going to say low. You can guess low, right? If you're talking about tribes, qua tribes, the answer is zero. Okay, if you're talking about tribal identity, so it's mentioned six times in the book of Shemot. By the way, the footnote on that in my book is actually wrong. I'm embarrassed to say I quoted a couple of the wrong verses, which is, doesn't usually happen, but forewarned. In any case, it happens six times in the book Shemot. Really, it's only twice, because each time we're dealing with Eliav, who comes from the tribe of Dan. He's identified as being from the tribe of Dan. Bezalel, who comes from the tribe of Yehuda, he's identified three times as being from the tribe of Yehuda, which is interesting. Sorry? Okay, and very good. Excellent. And Vayikra is the other time, which is also from the tribe of Dan, which is an interesting study in of itself. When God will, I skipped, as you know, I've written a series of books on Breishit Shemot, and I just put out Bamidbar. I skipped Vayikra, so when you get back to Vayikra, we'll try to deal with that, especially because that's one of the only two stories, right? Only two narratives in Sefer Vayikra, which is why I skipped it. You know, it's a little tricky, but God willing, we'll get to it at some point. Okay, so in Breishit and the beginning of Shemot, so we have individuals, right, who are identified as such. But that's pre Mitzrayim. That's going into Mitzrayim. That's the earlier phase of Jewish history. The 12 Shvatim as individuals. Seder, the Seder. But in any case, so all of a sudden, right, in Sefer Midbar, from start to finish, all we hear about, I mean, not exclusively so, but the beginning starts with mentions of the tribal leaders. It almost ends with the tribal leaders. There's a footnote after it, but the footnote at the end of the Midbar is also really an appendix, right? Same way we organize a book, sometimes something that doesn't fit in is an appendix. There's an appendix which is the story of the tribal leaders of Menashe, who complain about God's decision with the daughters of Slofchad, and that gets adjusted. But that's also very much about tribal rights, right? Tribal identity. Well, if we have time, we'll touch upon that story a little bit about Slofchad and the tribe of Menashe. But throughout, you have countings, right? What we say for Pekudim, numbers, is about what type of countings. Tribal countings, right? First and foremost, that's what really we're interested in. The numbers that are given are how many are in each tribe. And then we count up the whole, how many are in the Galim, right, which is a new concept, right? Division of three tribes, a new concept. And then the sum total of all the Jews. We have the various delegations that are sent. All of a sudden, it's become in vogue to have 12. Right, 12 is a new number that appears. I mean, again, it's not completely new, but you don't have these sort of delegations like you have with the scouts, one for each tribe. Right, matot, when an army is sent out to conquer Midian, it's one unit per tribe, each of 1,000, and if you break it up in terms of population, it's completely non-proportional. We'll get to that as well. The matot, right, to find out who's the leader. You have 12 matot, 12 sticks, right, to decide. So all of this is new, and perhaps most infamous, I don't know if it's proper to say about the Torah that something's infamous, but the reading that is very difficult to sit through in Naso, Parshat Naso, which is the tribal offerings, right, that the chieftains all give the same exact offering over and over and over again, all 12 times. A very difficult thing to understand what's the need to do that. And what I would propose is it's very important in terms of what Sefer Bamidbar is trying to do. And I'll speak a little bit more about that as we go on. But you get the picture that all of a sudden, from almost no discussion of tribes become at least a central, if not perhaps the central focus of this whole book. And as I said before, the idea being, how do we establish ourselves as a nation in Israel? And this is a system that's going to be used for a variety of reasons. Where's my bag? Anybody see my others? Okay. I have source, not really source sheets, I have a picture instead. We all prefer pictures to source sheets. It's more fun. We're actually going to get to this later, but why don't we pass them out now? There you go. Should be enough to go around. Okay. By the time they're around, I still won't have gotten to it. So, Okay. Okay, so what's the idea? Okay, so we said they're preparing for a settlement of the land of Israel. There needs to be some sort of structure, but it's more than that. In other words, both in terms of what happens and in terms of the emphases in the book, right, are trying to establish something, are trying to create facts on the ground. You know, there's something called identity formation here, right? If you don't belong to a group, if you don't belong to a community, or if you enter a situation where there are several communities, how do you internalize being a part of a community, right? Especially when none existed, a new nation, right? When Israel was created. How does one become an Israeli if one is not coming into one's life with such an identity? Okay? So what I think is going on, what the book emphasizes and what Moshe Rabbeinu tried to emphasize in various ways or we should really say HaKadosh Baruch Hu tries to organize in a variety of ways by all sorts of ceremonies as well as procedures, is to create the sense of identity. You know, if you think about it, before the marching orders, right, before in the beginning of the Midbar, the command as to how they should walk and how they should march, presumably they walked together with whoever they wanted to walk together. Presumably there was mixture, right? It had to be commanded. So, in other words, at that point when the Jews left Israel, the tribal identity was presumably very weak, right? And it was important to create such an identity over 38 years. The proof, or a proof, that this move, that this process was successful, is comparing, which I compare these two stories for other reasons in the book, comparing the story of the Meraglim, of the spies, the 12 spies, to the story of Gad and Reuven. Because we didn't know. No problem. The aspect I want to compare right now, or contrast actually, is when Kalev and Yeshua opposed the general consensus of not going into Israel, do you think that their tribes went along? They were the tribal leaders, after all. Do you have any indication one way or another? I think you do. What's the indication? Well, did they go along? Didn't go along. What's an indication? How do we know? Right, Bnei Yisrael were yelling, who got punished? Everyone got punished, right? Kalev and Yeshua are excluded, specifically they, right? So presumably what you have is a horizontal identification. There's the elite, there's the leaders, and they identify as a group, right? And there's the people, and they identify as one large group. There's no real tribal identification. The fact that my leader, if I'm from Yehuda, Kalev said, you know, we're going in, didn't really impact on me, because I didn't identify with Kalev. I identified with the group, right? It was Kalal Yisrael, in the best, or perhaps the worst sense of the word. You know, true unity for the wrong reason. By the time we get to Gad and Reuven, so who comes to Moshe? The pasuk says, Bnei Gad, Bnei Reuven, right? So do you really think the thousands of people came to Moshe and Aaron? Right? Probably not. Probably it's the same leadership delegation that you are, if it wasn't one, it's a group of men, perhaps women, though probably not. But in any case, you had a leadership delegation of people that went to Moshe Rabbeinu, and they're called Bnei Gad and Reuven. And clearly everybody in Gad Reuven is going along with it, right? They follow the leadership. So here, by the end of the book, and this is significant because you're dealing with year two, right, the beginning of the process, and you're dealing with year 40, the end of the process, right? At the beginning of the book, there's no sense of tribal identity. By the end of the book, there's a very strong sense of tribal identity. Okay? So the project succeeds, right? Why is it done? So there are a couple of reasons that I can understand, and there may be other reasons, and perhaps there are better reasons than what I'm going to propose, but I think that this may at least give us some direction. So number one, I think we go, I wrote in one of the chapters on Shemot about the blessing of Yaakov, even though that's in the book of Bereishit. I wrote about in Shemot, you know, you have leftover stuff, you have to get it in somehow, so that's what you do when you write a series. But what I spoke about over there, and Rav Hirsch speaks about very beautifully in an essay in his collected writings, is the benefits of specialization and differentiation. On some level, the way I approach the blessing of Yaakov is this is a strategy, and the context that I spoke about it in is why do Miriam, Moshe, and Aaron get along? Right? Nobody else has gotten along up until this time. Right? There's always been sibling rivalry and competition. And over in the book, my book on Shemot, I ascribe it to Yaakov's blessing in the sense that what he did was to give different assignments. Right? So if he has a soccer team, I guess that's the game of the season right now, and I remember I played soccer, and everybody wanted to be the front row center, right? But once I know I'm not front center and I'm the goalie, so I'm not going to compete with the front guy, I'm not going to compete with the defense guy. Everybody has their role to fulfill, right? Which sort of takes away the motivation for competition and ultimately for conflict. That's the, as far as I understand it, that's the secret, that's the strategy of Yaakov in dealing with this tremendous problem that's plagued the progenitors of the Jewish people and their families. Okay? So I would suggest that this moving towards the land of Israel, where we're going to see conflict between tribes, where we would have seen conflict without the tribes. It's simply the way of life that people compete for limited resources, and people's sense of pride, if it's not in their tribe, it's going to be in their family, right? And we have clan warfare in different nations and different regions, even in the United States, right? So it's a given that people are going to have conflict. The question is how can you channel that in the most effective way and try to neutralize it as best as possible, and not only neutralize it, but use this sense of will that people have to succeed and to outdo one another in a productive way. So if I can be a better center than you are a goalie, that's good for the team. Right, because I'm not really competing directly with you. I'm showing myself to be good at what my position is, not to compete with the other person. And I would suggest on some level, and I think we see that in the blessings of Moshe as well, that seems to be central to the strategy of tribalization. That the tribes are not only going to be separated, but are each going to be assigned certain tasks. We know that we associate certain tribes with trade and certain tribes with mishpat and so on and so forth. So I would suggest that that's one tachlit, one goal of this project. I think that there is a political goal that we see created here that serves the Jews well and was adopted by many nations, including the United States, and that... that idea is political federalism, meaning that you have smaller units that have a certain amount of autonomy, right? And for the Jewish people in the Tanakh, that's good, not necessarily for the best of reasons. It's good because you can jettison tribes that aren't doing what they need to do. This is on some level the story of the Civil War, right? To what extent are you a nation? To what extent do states have the right to do what they want to do? And what happens if they do something that the majority of the nation does not want them to do? Well, so the United States resolved it with a lot of bloodshed. I mean, whatever it is, not the casting judgment one way or another, But the Jewish approach was to split off, to split, and obviously it comes at great cost, but very much like one person is forced to amputate a limb, better that the body is able to survive without the limb then the body is brought down by the limb. And that's the notion politically, or at least the way it's used in Tanakh, in terms of the federal scheme. And we see that being used already. We mentioned Gad and Reuven before. We see that happening already there, where Gad and Reuven chart a separate course for themselves and they feel they have the ability to do that now that tribal consolidation has been affected, so that you have this goal as well. The third thing that tribalization, I think, tries to do, and perhaps this is more important in the modern period, in the sense that this was probably assumed by most people. Certainly it was assumed in the Middle Ages in Western writings, in Christian and other Western writings throughout the Middle Ages and even through the Renaissance. The idea of corporate identity, that you're really part of something larger. Again, as in the modern period, we think of ourselves very much as individuals. And as a result, we need to be reminded, I quoted Alistair MacIntyre, a philosopher at Notre Dame, fairly well known, who says that we are at best only partially in control of our own narratives. In other words, we're born to certain families, born to certain cultures, and you can choose to ignore that and suffer the consequences, or you can work with it. And so tribal identity is reinforcing corporate identity in the sense that a family is taken for granted. You may not pause if you're told you're part of a family. A nation is taken for granted. Everybody, regardless, is simply for obvious reasons, is part of a nation and is part of a family, so it doesn't cause us to think twice about it. To be part of a subgroup, right, to establish subgroups all of a sudden creates a new identity that I have to think about. And I would suggest that the Torah is interested in that as well, especially if you take the view, as I do, that the Torah is speaking to different generations in that generation's language and for that generation's understanding, which is the way I understand Masa Avot Siman Lebanim, a phrase that Ramban makes quite famous, that the stories in the Torah that are given to the ancestors are an indication for us as to how to understand our future, meaning that we find things that would not have been understood by our ancestors in the Torah, and the Torah is aiming specifically at us. So whether corporate identity was already assumed by them or not, it's certainly something that's not assumed by us, and perhaps for us, excuse me, becomes the central lesson here. Okay, so that's a little bit about what the Torah wants the Jewish people to get out of this tribal scheme. Like I said, that's probably the tip of the iceberg. There's room for more discussion about that. But I want to move on a little bit and speak about two other topics in general. The first one is, what does the Torah want us to know about the tribes specifically? In other words, while it's trying to create this tribal identity, it's also telling us a lot about these tribes. Okay? And I think there's three things. The first two are sort of flip sides of the same coin. It wants to teach us that there's equality among the tribes, but also wants to teach us that there's hierarchy among the tribes. Right? It's sort of balance. In the book, I compare this to the arrangement that you have in the United States government, where you have the Senate and the House of Representatives, the Senate being very unequal. If you ever pause to think about it, very, very much hierarchical, although here it's randomly so. It's hierarchical in the sense that Wyoming is represented in the Senate, I think, 80 times more than California. Right. That's pretty wild. I wonder if the Founding Fathers ever thought of such a possibility. But be that as it may, and the House of Representatives that is completely equal in terms of proportional representation. But okay, the truth is that that's not a good example for what I'm trying to illustrate right now, but put that on the side. In any case, there's hierarchy on the one hand, there's equality on the other. And then finally, the third thing, and this is very important to the student of Tanakh, the Torah is trying to, in Sefer Bamidbar particularly, is trying to ground our understanding of tribal legacies. Meaning, I mentioned before Shaul as being a Benjaminite king, so the truth is in Bamidbar, Benjamin doesn't really appear as a character. But I mentioned also the essay I recently wrote on Shimshon. So Dan appears a little bit more, but even more so, we'll get a chance to speak about it at the end. There's a lot of discussion about Yehuda, a lot of discussion about Shimon, a lot of discussion about Menashe, about Reuven and Gad. And the identities that we're going to see later on in Tanakh are very much rooted in the stories about these people. And it behooves us, again, as students of Tanakh, to keep a careful eye on this. And I found that very few people really give this serious thought about tracing out the tribal identities in Tanakh, partly because, speaking at the lunch table yesterday, that we don't identify with our tribe. I mean, we tend to all be from Yehuda, whether we realize it or not, but we have people from Benjamin, a few from the other tribes, and of course, Levim and Kohanim. And I would posit that the rabbis also were not strong on this, even though they do discuss this many times. But I think the rabbis in Talmud also were very, or perhaps not as much as we are, but were also disconnected from their tribal heritage, because this was way after the exile of the 10 tribes. So once the 10 tribes are out of the picture, it's difficult for us to connect. Yeah, sorry.
So I guess I'll put the question to my mind when you bring up the tribes and that whole genealogy that you're creating that in the modern biblical scholarship seems to trace it more than the rabbis.
Okay.
Because it opens up the slippery slope conversation of, well, if these are the tribes that are highlighted and these are the tribes that are highlighted later, oh, it must be that it was a later
retraction. Right, so right, right, right. Yeah.
I mean, you know,
yeah, I don't think one has to go in that direction.
Well,
yeah, yeah.
Is that a comment towards why that wasn't part of the conversation? Because you wouldn't think it would.
The rabbis do mention often and it was my second class. Yeah, in my second class this afternoon, and if you'll be there, so I'll bring a few statements from the rabbis specifically connected to the discussion this afternoon, which is about Shimon and Levi. So the rabbis were interested. Perhaps not as much as Bible scholarship. I don't know, although I don't get a sense that that's overwhelming there either. But you can take it. You can take it backwards and you take it forwards. I think that's ultimately a very sharp distinction between academic Bible study, which assumes there's really no such thing as prophecy of reading forward what's going to happen, and therefore one has to read backward into what we know now is we're going to write back into what were their roots. So again, it's a question of assumptions, but certainly I don't think that it should prevent us from taking that approach at all. So I think it's very helpful. And again, I think the rabbis sanctioned. I mean, essentially what's going on with rabbinic interpretation is that there's a lot of different methodologies that are used, but rarely is it very systematic. And what we can add, a few things to rabbinic interpretations, but I think one thing in particular that's being done, I think, very much in our generation, is sort of systematization of their approach, of, you know, really looking across the board. The rabbis had tremendous, they knew the Tanakh by heart. But we have the advantage that we can use a computer, and it hopefully comes quicker than the type of computer you have. Okay, so in any case, so those are three things I want to speak a little bit about: hierarchy, equality, and the roots of tribal characteristics in Tanakh, and then I will open it up. So I gave you the chart. There's a few more if people came late. Anybody need charts? No, you got it? Okay, excellent. Okay, so I'm going to start with hierarchy and just give you one example. But the truth is, before I give you that example, you should just note that the order that's given, we said that many times the tribes are mentioned, whether as groups or individual representatives. Right? We mentioned the scouts, for example. We're going to see the princes being mentioned by name at various points in Sefer Bamidbar. The order is not always the same. The order is always, my contention is the order is always significant in terms of some sort of tribal meaning. The Nitziv at one point discusses the one order and saying it has nothing to do with the tribes, it has only to do with the individuals because he couldn't make order of it. But I think that that's not the case. That if you look in all of the orders, you always notice certain people towards the top and other people throughout the bottom. You're going to find the eldest sons of Leah at the top almost always. You're going to find the Yosef cluster, the Rachel cluster of tribes usually in the middle, and you're going to find the Shvachot usually towards the end. There are exceptions, but I think we can understand the exceptions according to this pattern. So that's something that automatically, order is order. Order is significant, especially when you see certain tribes which you'd expect to see anyways at the top. The Torah is reinforcing the notion that certain tribes are, I don't know if we can say better than others, but certain tribes have more of a leadership role than others. And Reuven, Yehuda are the prime contenders in Sefer Bamidbar for leadership. Very parallel to what happens in Bereishit, almost repeating the pattern where Reuven is the default, but by way of merit is pushed away by Yehuda. It's interesting that in spite of that, the pushing away happens primarily in two chapters. Again, the chapter of the Meraglim and the chapter of Gad and Reuven. Again, these stories being extremely significant in terms of framing what I call the real Bamidbar. Just an aside, taking the Netziv's approach, which is based on a statement of the rabbis, I think the Gemara Shabbat, that the famous nuns that you find in Baalotcha separate between the first part, the first 10 chapters of the Midbar, and the rest of the book. And in my book, I call the first part the ideal Bamidbar, and the second part the real Bamidbar. So in the real Bamidbar, your two bookends are the story of the Meraglim and the story of Gad and Reuven. And these are also the stories where Yehuda shows leadership through Kalev and by lack of being associated with the scheme of Gad and Reuven. And Reuven shows a lack of leadership by taking the wrong side in the story of the Meraglim and taking the wrong side in the decision to take Transjordan, take the other side of the Jordan. But even before that, it's sort of foreshadowed in the Degalim, which you have a picture of in this chart, where the first camp is not led by Reuven, but is led by Yehuda. Be that as it may, the story in Sefer Bamidbar parallels what happens in Bereishit, where Reuven is the default, but the Torah shows us that he is not meant to be the leader. Right, of course, God already knows that, right? And therefore, in the Degalim, even though Reuven is mentioned first in the first order of the princes, and in the census, when it comes to the Degalim in the marching order, so Yehuda's formation is chosen first. So I just want to briefly look at this chart and show you that it's not an obvious formation. And my general thesis about it being some sort of pecking order, again, in terms of leadership. And in the book, I suggest that east-west is placed before north-south in terms of importance. One doesn't have to agree with that, and I suggest the other possibility, the obvious possibility is that you go first camp, second camp, third camp, fourth camp. But in the book, I think defend the notion that the first camp is really followed by the third camp in terms of leadership, and certainly in terms of the Jewish future, right? In terms of Malchut Yisrael, the northern kingdom, you're going to see Menashe and Ephraim taking a leader role, and the fact that Benjamin stays with Yehuda also is showing a certain type of leadership, besides the fact that Shaul comes from Benjamin, whereas Gad, Reuven, and Shimon, I think on some level the only thing that makes them even number three is their lineage, in the sense that these are really the failed tribes, and we speak about that in the book as well. Gad and Reuven, for the reason, the story we keep on repeating about their decision to go on the other side of Jordan. And Shimon is fantastic if you take careful reading, and we'll discuss it a little bit this afternoon in the other class. But Shimon sort of disappears. I don't know if you ever noticed that. Already in the blessing of Moshe, the words of the Ramban, notwithstanding, who makes the claim, the Ramban is usually very tight, but here, I presume he must be motivated by Kabbalistic notions, and he says the reason that Moshe does not include Shimon in the bracha is that he really does, but he has to hide him because you can only have 12. You can only have 12, 12 is the number, and if you're going to include Levi, which Moshe does, which is also a story in of itself, but we'll have to wait for Dvarim to speak more about that, that Shimon really is not there in the blessing. So Shimon is not there in the blessing, and it's not by random. Shimon is a problematic tribe from the get-go, right? A problematic individual. And when you come to the division of the land and say for Yeshua, he's sort of completely enclosed and submerged by Yehuda, and we almost never hear from Shimon again. We hear quite a bit from, as far as I recall, every other tribe, but Shimon sort of disappears from Jewish history. So you have a problematic Degel as a second camp, and again, the Bible scholar, the academic scholar, will say, you know, that's looking backwards. You know, they did not succeed. So even though they didn't do anything wrong yet, we can't place them at the forefront. We can't make them the leadership. But we'll make the opposite claim again, that this is a type of prophecy that God already is aware that Reuven, partially echoing, say for Breishit, that Reuven is not meant for the leadership, and so he's usurped even before anything happens by Yehuda. If you're going to put Yehuda first, one might still have put Shimon together with Yehuda, right? The fact that we go to the child 5 and 6 of Leah is interesting. It's not something that you would do automatically. The division of Gad and Asher is of interest, right? Why does Gad move up? In other words, the third camp is obvious. The children of Rachel would be in the third camp. The first, second, and third camp, first, second, and fourth camp really need explanation. Now, one could, I'm not going to give alternative explanations, but I think the message is clear enough from this diagram that this is not an order that's obvious and automatic. One can explain it. There's obviously a logic to it. Again, you can take a look at the book if you can't figure it out yourself. But what the Torah seems to be interested in creating these degalim and putting it in the order that it's doing is to foreshadow certain trends, hierarchical trends in terms of leadership. So that's on the one side. So we said on the one side, the Torah is trying to create a hierarchy for us to understand that Yehuda is going to be the leader, that certain other tribes are going to have a higher role and other tribes are going to have a lesser role, and that's how they're organized. We said on the other hand, we have a certain equality that's being pushed, right? Each time, mentioned before, each time there's a mentioning of 12, right? 12 delegates. Even here, the notion of a degel consisting of three tribes, we said there should be three tribes. Why not do it according to size? You'll notice the population is very uneven, right? That camp number one is almost two times as big as camp number three, right? So if we wanted to divide it more evenly, we could spread the tribes around and put the two largest tribes together and four smaller tribes together. The Torah is not interested in doing that because it's pushing the notion of symmetry of a certain level of equality. And again, the reading we spoke about, Naso, of one tribe after another, it's not enough to simply say, from the fifth tribe on, they also did this. No, every tribe has to be brought up that to be equal on some level. And if you think about it, this is a tremendous statement about corporate identity, right? Again, we mentioned the example of the United States Senate, which is certainly not straightforward thinking in our in 21st century conceptions of proportional representation. We very much think, I mean, it's interesting that it's never challenged in the United States. I think part of the reason is you need to ratify, to change the Constitution, so you need a majority of states, or two-thirds of states, I think, right? And there's more, most of those states are smaller, so I don't think it's ever going to happen. But it's quite interesting that the statement that was being made by the founding fathers, at least the way I understand it in this particular case, is that a person doesn't only have individual identity, but also has a corporate identity. In other words, it's important that California be represented as California, and not just, I shouldn't just be represented as who I am, you know, me, myself, and I, but I should also be represented as part of this corporate body. And there's the same way as I'm represented, a state is represented, and I'm part of that state. It would be improper for me to be represented with more representation than any other state, because all the states are units. There's no such thing as a big unit and a small unit, in the same way as there's no such thing as a person getting two votes. Right? I can't, maybe a person's more intelligent, more wise, whatever. No, in terms of the notion of equal representation, each person is one entity, each state is one entity, and the Torah is presenting the notion that each tribe is an individual entity with the same rights as every other tribe, which is a very interesting conception. So on the one hand, yes, there are some tribes that are going to have a greater leadership role than others, but there is a certain baseline equality that applies to all of the tribes. Okay? Finally, the last thing I want to focus on is the stories, right? There's a tribal project in general, but there are specific tribes that are being picked out to help us understand their future in the Tanakh. So I'm just going to discuss one or two, which I speak about again in my book. I think one of the most interesting discussions is about the tribe of Manasseh, who, you know, is very much on the side in Chumash. I mean, granted, he's one of the two parts of Yosef. Yosef is a major character, so on that level, he is discussed. Perhaps someone who is not at the forefront in classic way, as is the tribe of Yehuda. And one, you know, in the book I speak about the very interesting story of the daughters of Tzelofehad, which is paralleled by the later story that we mentioned before about the tribal leaders complaining about the decision given to the daughters of Tzelofehad. First of all, in my humble opinion, it's extremely unlikely that these women were the only women in the situation, right? People are dying according to tradition, right? Everybody's dying in the desert over the 40 years, right? We're talking about year 40, right? So a lot of people have died. To think that they're the only ones that died with, that their father is the only one that died without sons and with daughters, is probably statistically, I guess you can't have a statistic impossibility, but it would be very close to statistically impossible. So my sense is there were other women in such situations, in such situations. And the daughters of Lofhad are the only ones that stepped up with that, with this complaint. And the Torah clearly places them as daughters of Menashe. In other words, they're not just great women, which they are, but they're tribal actors. I think it's very significant. It's very important to take a look at that. And then I think a lot of the things in the story start making sense. First of all, one of the things that has puzzled commentators for, you know, since the Torah was written, is what's Menashe, what's the half-tribe of Menashe doing on the other side of the Jordan? Again, there's certain things that we read each year and we pass it up, and once we see the question, we say, wait a second, how did someone pull that by me? So Reuven and Gad ask for the land over the Jordan. They have a whole discussion with Moshe. Discussion is concluded. They're allowed to go. Then Moshe says, okay, Gad, Reuven, and Menashe, get over here, right? You're going to join. Where did that come from? Right? And it's very, very difficult to understand it. And Siv's one of the few that makes a stab at it, but his answer, again, my humble opinion, is very speculative. He says that Menashe is sort of a watchdog being sent to watch these problematic tribes. Where do you get that from? So my understanding is something very different going on here. And essentially, I'll give you the thesis and I'll give you more support for the thesis. The thesis is how I understand Menashe's being thrown, being divided, as well as why it's specifically the Zarz of Slofchad that come forward, and I'll mention some other things that are going on, is because Menashe is all about creative bifurcation. What do I mean? Well, let me first explain what I mean, then I'll say what I mean by that. Yaakov creates two nations. I have an article on this in the Jewish Bible Quarterly, I think it's whatever it's called. It's Jewish Bible Quarterly, about this very strange dual personality of Yaakov. Right? He has two names, he has two wives, two main wives, two groups of children, he creates two nations ultimately, right? Machanayim. You can read the article, it's better than what I can do on one foot now. I think you can even download it for free online, so you can look it up afterwards if you want. In any case, Yaakov creates this legacy of what I call creative bifurcation, of creating dual identities and being involved in a dual identity himself. My contention is that he passes this on to Yosef. Right? Yosef is further divided into two tribes, into Ephraim and Menashe. And interestingly enough, it seems that that characteristic can only be passed on to one child. Yaakov passes it on only to Yosef. Yosef, I would contend, passes it on only to Menashe. And I would suggest that that's why specifically the daughters of Slofchad are the ones that are willing to break away from their tribe, because that's what they're asking Moshe. That's the point of contention. The point of contention is, can we keep the land even though we're going to marry into other tribes? Essentially saying that we're allowed to divorce ourselves or divorce a part of the tribe from that tribe. And I would suggest that Moshe's response to that, the story of Gad and Reuven and the apportionment of Ever Yarden, the other side of Jordan, comes after that story. Artificially so, or at least artificially before the sequel to that story, that in fact what Moshe is doing, or God is doing really, is a sort of midah keneged midah, since they're not connected to their tribe, and Menashe has this characteristic of bifurcation, of lack of tribal consolidation, which is the project that we mentioned in Sefer Bamidbar. On some level, their challenge is problematic. And on some level, they're not sent into exile, which is how I understand what happens to Gad and Reuven. Gad and Reuven don't want to go to Israel, so Moshe says, because it's hate. So you want Golas? Go to Golas. You want to punish yourselves? Punish yourselves. But by Menashe, what I would suggest is going on something different, that this characteristic of division is usually a very good thing. It's not a good thing in the first generation. And therefore, their request, which has its merits, is partially problematic. It's partially not recognizing the general project. And as a result, the midah keneged midah is a splitting, of Menashe. Menashe is the only... What's going on with the splitting? It's not just that they're dragged to the other side of the Jordan for no apparent reason. It's also that where do we hear at this time of the Tanakh? Later on, we have Dan, can't find enough land. Okay, but here, what's the notion of splitting a tribe? And it would suggest that this is very much in line with the characteristics of that tribe. And I think that helps us understand two other interesting notions, which again are fairly unique in Torah, certainly. That being the splitting that I mentioned before of the story itself, right? The story, and some say chronologically, of the elders of Menashe should be right after the request of Bnot Tzlofchad, right? It's not. It's separated, right? No, separated in the same way that Menashe separates and divides. You want to say?
Are you saying that they're the ones that came forward because they had, in their tribe, they had less sense of tribal
Correct.
Identity and work?
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly right. It also helps us understand a rabbinic explanation, which is, to the best of my knowledge, unique in the Torah, but you can correct me if I'm wrong about that. It's certainly very rare. And that's the notion of a split decision. What am I talking about? So the idea, the men of Menashe come to Moshe and say, you know, this is going to be a problem for us. We're going to lose territory. So Moshe's response is, you're right. Women in that situation should only marry members of their own tribe. Incidentally, the rabbis say that excluded the daughters of Tzlofchad, which I think is, if you're going to accept that reading, is a proof for what I'm suggesting, there were others in that situation. Right? That's certainly the way the rabbis read the text. In any case, the decision is given only to marry people in your tribe, according to Chazal in the Gemara, is that only applies in the first generation. There's an interesting Ramban explaining why that's the case. But for our purposes, what's fascinating is you have a split decision, again, specifically coming by the tribe of Menashe. So again, I think what we're understanding here is that Menashe has this role to play of creative bifurcation. What I mean by that is the creating of new identities, that new situations require new identities. It's not enough to simply go with what you have. And one tribe, that's what they're going to excel in. In general, that's a good thing. Menashe will do that successfully in the Tanakh. But at the time of Sefer Bamidbar, it's slightly problematic, and that's what I think is going on throughout much of the story. Okay, I have about 5 minutes left, so I can say more, and I will say more, but if there's any questions or comments, because I want to run out of time, Yeah.
I'm just curious if the standard in those days was you married in your tribe, and that they were breaking the standard by marrying out, or
That's an interesting question. So I have nothing to go on except, you know, I've never thought of that question. I'm going to tell you my gut response to that is that this is exactly one of the things that God was trying to establish, that people would marry into their own tribe. And by year 40, that is likely more the rule than not. But by the same token, you know, there's only so much you can do in 38 years. So that, yes, that may have been the norm. But if I'm getting to the end of your thing, I don't know if you're going in this direction, but certainly I think it should be addressed. Of all the other women that might have been in the same situations of Bnot Tzlofchad, number one, again, I imagine it was a fairly reasonably sized group. I'd be surprised if no one else wanted to marry outside the camp. And even if no one else did, I think that himself would be saying something about the daughters of Tzlofchad. Yeah. Yeah, right, correct. No, but the question is, would others do the same? Yes, go ahead.
You portray the splitting of Menashe into and out of Israel as almost immediate negative meet up to punishment.
Right.
But it seems, I don't know if there's been a few specific questions of Washburn, but I've certainly heard varying opinions on not as a function, but as needing a sort of a job, meaning you don't want Reuben and Gad to be sort of, you know, cut off from the rest of Israel and having no contact. You need a group that sort of subtly melts consistently back and forth to Menasseh be that root. It seems that this isn't a punishment of Menasseh for breaking away from the process, but actually this is Menasseh's role in the process. They're the best at splitting, and we need a group that can
Do that. Okay, so you can go in that direction as well. Moshe.
That it says it's Davka to point out that there was not a Tamata. The people generally did marry after.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That would be pre-tribal consolidation.
But also that now you have the people of Menasseh saying, yeah, but let's make sure that they do marry after which seems to reinforce the notion that at least it was not a
done deal.
That it was not an automatic
Right. Okay. Yeah.
What can we infer from all this about what God wants for the Jewish people today?
Yeah, good question. Again, my bottom line lesson, take home on this, I always try to have some sort of take home, is the importance of corporate identity. I quoted Alistair McIntyre before. I think the notion of strong individualism is at least problematic in Judaism, and I think in how we think about ourselves, not that we're not individuals, and I speak about the interplay between individual identity and group identity, but I think given where the rest of Western society is going, it's critically important to, I mean, McIntyre is sort of a renegade philosopher, he's not in the mainstream, I think it's critically important to appreciate that this is that corporate identity of identifying with a group personality, if you will, that I am much more than just myself, and I have to somehow internalize what's the, you know, I mean, identify with the, you know, Hegelian thought on this, and the notion of Volksgeist, of having a sense of national genius. Echad Ha'am also, and Rav Kook also get into such a notion. Again, on one foot, from where I'm coming from, I think it's a critical reminder that we have to think more in those type of terms, even as society is thinking otherwise. Okay, any other? Okay, so I'm sort of out of time, so I'll just pitch the book in the last minute. I have books for sale here I brought with me, $20 a copy. If anybody's interested, you'll see some of the things we've talked about presented much better. As Chaim Soloveitchik said, when you go on these trips, you know, you present in poor English, which you've worked so hard to write in good English. So you want to say something before?
I was just curious about you touched briefly on the idea of underdog
or the real underdog. Yeah. The ideal in the first 10 chapters again is a sort of just ordering of the tribes, creating a sense of where everybody belongs, of a sense of how many are we, some very essential laws that are necessary. Things fall apart after, in the middle of Baal Lotcha, and, you know, as most of us know, that's very much real life. Real life hits the Jewish people in the second part of the Midbar, and they're two very different narratives. One just sort of teaser that I'm going to give you, that really Moshe is meant for the ideal and he succeeds in the ideal, but he's not meant for the real and therefore fails in the real, and the leadership automatically can't belong to him, and the rest of Sefer Midbar is we just, you know, experienced in past week's parsha is a sort of the unraveling of that story. Okay, thanks, and I hope to see you guys later.